so forcefully. Now, though, those matters suddenly became pressing. The High Lords had failed in their most sacred duty of all, protecting the heart of power, and in centuries past that had always resulted in swift punishment and a change of personnel at High Table. I avoided contact with my masters at that time, though, and immersed myself in doing what I could to help with the restoration of the palace systems. I issued requisition commands and lent my services to those commanders still retaining regiments capable of deployment. I signed warrants for resupply and passed on execution mandates to the Arbites. I think, looking back, I was in some kind of shock. Jack said later that I was like an automaton, moving from one task to another and barely saying a word to her or anyone else. I lost weight, which in normal circumstances might have been welcome, but back then just made me look haggard. My memories of that period are fuzzy, and I do not recall much of the detail. One episode stands out, though. Urthu Hematalian, who had ever been a thorn in my side, and so it was with much irritation that I responded to a summons from his much-diminished private staff and travelled halfway across the palace to find him. He had always been a sallow figure, but now he looked positively ghostly. I tried to imagine how he felt about the recent disasters. He was the master of the Administratum, that stupendously vast edifice that controlled the flow of information between systems and the center. More than any of us, he traded in communication, the endless tide of parchment that was our empire's oxygen. Now, though, he was blind and near powerless, cut adrift from his own servants by the madness of his astropaths and the impossibility of void travel. Other High Lords, like Arx or Phaedix, could still use their curtailed networks of control and subterfuge. But Hematalian's realm was the visible Imperium, its scholars and its scriptoria, and that had been revealed as perhaps the most fragile Adeptus Stratum of them all. We walked together in the cloister of an old oratory set within his sprawling private estate, its stonework caked in spidery lichen. The skies above us still burned with that mournful ember glow, and every so often we would look up at it, fearful that the blood rain would start again. Hematalian, a tall and gaunt figure beside my waddling frame, twitched as he walked, a nervous tic I had never noticed him suffer from before.
"You've been hard to reach, Chancellor," he said.
"Apologies, Master. There's been much to attend to."
"No doubt. But this is a time for the Council to remain strong. We must rebuild, and swiftly. And yet, there have been disturbing rumors."
I looked at him. I genuinely didn't know what they might be.
"Oh?"
Hematalian pressed his lips skeptically together.
"You want me to say it? You want me to say the words? Very well. Your friend, the Primarch, that's the problem. What are we to make of him?"
I had no idea. No one had any idea. There were no precedents. The last living Primarch had disappeared into myth thousands of years ago, and even the great archives of the Lex did not stretch back that far.
"He is the Lord Commander," I ventured. "He was the Lord Commander. He was many things. He was part of the rebellion that brought us so close to annihilation he curtailed his own power to prevent it happening again."
Hematalian sniffed.
"They're still saying this brings us a new dawn. I fear it only brings the old night back."
I didn't have an argument. Just as it had been before my mad obsession with the Adeptus Custodes, I had reverted to being a cipher for the views of the powerful. "Do the others feel likewise?" I asked.
"Some do. There's been too little time to form a consensus."
He stopped walking and drew closer.
"He's no longer within the great halls. They tell me Valoris took him down to the heart of the sanctum. I'm informed he's still there. They say he's descended into the throne room itself."
I looked at him steadily.
"If any can do so, surely it's him. None of us ever ventured it. Did you ever wish to? The master was in no mood for humour, however bleak. He'll take control, he said. That's the danger. We'll win this battle, only to see terror taken from us. And what then? Another great crusade? A purge of all we've striven to build? You can see it, I trust. The danger. I remembered how I had felt on Luna, witnessing that pain of recognition in Gilliman's eyes. I found myself thinking that a purge of all we had striven to build might be no bad thing. Now perhaps you understand the folly of what you were trying to engineer before, the master said, starting to walk again. You would have sent the custodians into the inferno at Cadia just when they were needed here. Without them, we'd have lost the Lion's Gate. The enemy might have breached the inner sanctum. You've played a reckless game, Cancellarius, and need to remember where your loyalties lie. Perhaps he sensed my shell-shocked state, and so felt able to speak to me thus. I would never have tolerated it before. The Council must remain strong, he repeated. While the Lord Gilliman remains within the sanctum, we have our chance to act. I have already agreed with Pereth to forbid all fleet movements off-world. Arx has instructed those close to her to cordon off the sights on Luna and begin to limit the fallout from the Lion's Gate encounter. We can have a million more troops here within days if the orbital defences are now deemed overmanned. They all owe their allegiance to us. The Titans are within Raskin's purview, as are the Skitari maniples in system, and he's with us. I could hardly believe what I was hearing. We had been reduced to this, it seemed, squabbling over the conduits of power, even as the throne world disintegrated into starvation and lawlessness, and our walls were heaps of demon-infested rubble. With respect, Lord, I do not think this is the time to... This is the only time we will ever have. Here's a Primarch. You know your forbidden history. They were fratricidal lunatics prepared to tear the entire galaxy apart to pursue their feuds. We designed the Lex. He designed the Lex precisely to stop them doing it ever again. He cannot take control. I smiled grimly. And how would you stop him? He was once the commander of a legion. The legions are no longer here, though, are they? They're gone into history, just where they ought to be. Not all, I said. Hematalion nodded. You are right. One remains, one legion. The Emperor's legion. You did what you could to bring it under our control, I suppose. That was never my intention. Valoris is one of us now, and he must be made to see reason. I remembered how the Captain General had been back in the crypt when I had dared to try to impose my will on his. He would not suffer himself to be a pawn in our games. That was why they had resisted being dragged to the table for so long. He must have known of this danger, or seen something like it coming. We had prided ourselves on all our activity, rushing around with our edicts and our policies, and thinking the custodians moribund relics of a long-gone age. But they had played the quiet game more perfectly than us, and now held the balance of power in their etched gauntlets. I remembered what Valerian had told me. We are not a part of your Imperium. We involve ourselves within it only if we deem that his will demands it. They won't work for us, I said. Not now, not ever. And I was never trying to achieve that. All I wanted was to see them set free. Haster's face still haunted me. I wanted to see them take the fight to the enemy. Then you'll give him all he wants, said Hematalion. You'll give him the crusade he lusts for, and the blood tide will rise so high we'll all drown in it. I'll give no one anything, I said, growing impatient. You see anything in my hands, master? I've lost it all. We all have. He grabbed my shoulder, forcing me to face him. He's only one soul, and he's not been here long. He twitched heavily, and I felt his body spasm through my robes. They say that this Imperium is a rotten corpse, a shell of what it once was. I've never believed that. We're greater now than we've ever been, and these trials are no different to the ones we overcame before. We're hardier, We're tougher. We faced the dark for longer than he ever did. His age is over. We're the inheritors of the mantle.
I looked into his eyes and saw how poorly they focused now.
He can't take this from us, he said. He can't be allowed to.
When I next spoke, I did so carefully. Then, what do you wish me to do? I asked.
Support us. Keep the cordon in place. Resist the Adeptus Custodes being dragged into this. If he wants to launch a crusade of his own, let him kill himself alone out there. He must not become the new Lord of Terror. Valoris must remain with us.
I don't know whether he believed all of that. Perhaps he truly thought that Gilliman would usher in yet more destruction, or maybe he only feared for his own standing in this new Imperium. All I knew was that I had been convinced of something back then, driven by a force that it took a long time to recognize. Hematalion had done me some service, albeit unintentionally. As I listened to his desperation, I felt some of that resolve return. I hadn't been wrong, not entirely. This was not about the Council and not about the Primarch. This was about what Valerian had said. This was about his will. I serve the High Lords, as I ever have, I said, looking the Master of the Administratum in the eye, knowing that it was now a lie, and unable to feel a shred of guilt.
Chapter 24. Valerian. In the days after that, we counted the cost. Close to 4,000 of my brothers had been committed to the fighting at the Lion's Gate, and more than half of them had perished. Those were staggering losses for us. We had not absorbed such pain since the secret war of ancient memory, and I remember reading the tally of the fallen with astonishment. Tribune Italia was one of those who had perished, falling even as he slew one of the greater demons. Other names I knew well were on those lists, some I mourned greatly for in the months that followed. A few of the gravely wounded were taken to the Tower of Hegemon to be interred into dreadnought sarcophagi, though the practice had become so rare for us that there were not enough chassis for all those who needed one, and thus we lost souls who might have still served. The grief was real, but our capacity to fight, as well as our resolve for it, was undiminished. In this, we were not like the Adeptus Astartes. We did not have settled companies and chapters that were led by irreplaceable individuals. To a certain extent, we were islands, able to work together when the war demanded, but otherwise entirely self-sufficient. We retrieved the armor of our fallen comrades. We gave them honor as we took the bodies down into the hallowed tombs of remembrance, and then we turned our minds to what came next. I recalled the exchange I had had with Chancellor Tyron. Those old debates had felt esoteric at the time, a distraction from our ancient duties and rituals, but they preyed on my mind now. We all knew that the Captain General had taken a place on the High Council, something that bound us more closely to their deliberations than before, but we did not know where that would lead us. So much was changing, and it seemed inevitable that we would be caught up in it somehow. By then, I had also heard about the Lord Gilliman. News of his return had spread through the palace quickly, first in hushed whispers, then in increasingly confident tones from the mouths of those who knew the truth. Few had laid eyes on him since his triumphal entry to the sanctum, and it was widely believed that Valoris had now taken him to the throne room, where the two of them remained closeted for many days. An adjutant had been assigned to him, the new tribune Colquan, Italia's replacement, who would act as liaison between him and the Captain General. But otherwise, he served as little more than a background presence, a legend that had not yet stepped fully into the light. Some of my brothers had witnessed him fight during the height of the Battle of the Lion's Gate, of course, though they said little about it, and I had little interest in finding out more. A Primarch was a Primarch. We preceded them, just as the Sisters of Silence preceded them. We knew the truth of what they had done for the Imperium, both for good and for ill, And also we understood what role our master had intended for them in the beginning, as well as what he had hoped for following the apocalypse of the siege. If one of that fraternity had indeed returned to bolster our flagging defences, then that could be welcomed. Our duty would remain as it had always been, as it had been before the legions had been created, and as it had been after they were dissolved. For myself, I had other priorities. Once my wounds had healed and my armor was repaired, I did what I had sworn I would do and sought out Tanau Alea. I found her in quarters set aside within the palace, specifically for the returned Sisters of Silence. They were ancient buildings, once used to train and garrison the thousands of Null Maidens of the Imperium, but more recently used as a fortress for the Inquisition. There was talk of reinstating the archaic Somnos Citadel on Luna in due course, but that was not something that could be done quickly, and so, for the time being, the new arrivals were herded together here, where the need was greatest. It took me some time to locate her cell within that huge and ramshackle edifice. The Inquisition had burned all their records on leaving, as well as destroying or removing many of the old chamber furnishings, leaving the fortress dark, dank and cold. Servitors were everywhere, hauling machinery and lumen banks, power coils and supply canisters. The sound of turbo drilling echoed up from the foundations, and I saw huge void shield generators being winched into place by heavy cargo lifters. Some of the fortress's new occupants had served with Imperial institutions for a long time already, and so the adjustment needed for a life within the new dispensation was small. They retained their own armor, mostly still bearing the sigils of individual black ships, and carried weapons marked by heavy use. Those sisters made the sign of the Aquila as I passed them, and I returned the gesture of acknowledgement. The sensation of being surrounded by so many null souls in such a confined space was, I admit, unnerving. The effect was cumulative, and the further in that I went, the more I became aware of the strange sense of numbness in the filtered air. I had noticed it less during the heat of battle, but now, with something like normality restored, I could begin to understand why it had been so easy for them to slip away from us. It was hard to be around them, to tolerate the vague and nagging sense of wrongness that they exuded. I resolved to concentrate, to overcome such quintessentially human weakness. I was supposed to be beyond such things, after all. Eventually, I found her down in the very lowest level, where the ceilings dripped with rusty fluids and the air was thick with mold spores. Those chambers looked more like jail cells than spaces in which to meditate. Knowing the identity of the previous occupants, it was likely that they had been. When I entered, she was staring at a piece of stretched leather placed between staves of iron. She was so intent on her study that she didn't hear me approach, and I was reduced to that most human of gestures, a faint cough. She looked up, her face a picture of irritation. She must have recognized me, but I received no welcome. "What do you want?" she signed. "To give you my thanks," I said, "and to register my debt to you." I was not sure whether to use thought mark or speak out loud. The first seemed presumptuous, the second incongruous. "For what? And why? It was just fighting." When I had last seen her, she had been near collapse from exhaustion. In the days since the battle, she had obviously been fed and given medicine, her armor hurriedly repaired, the foul blood burned from her sword, and the steel sanctified by priests. But she still looked drained. "It was a mighty deed," I said, "to cripple that beast."
"It wasn't a beast. It was a Shedim. You'd have done the same for me. It doesn't make us soul siblings."
The degree of resentment in her voice took me aback. Maybe I had become too accustomed to either awe or fear from those I served, to be faced with irascibility. That was novel. "Forgive me, sister. My presence here is unwelcome." She turned on me, her eyes flashing.
"Yes, Shield Captain. Your presence here is unwelcome. It has been unwelcome for 10,000 years. Throne, damn you, I wonder you have the nerve to face me at all.
I could hardly keep up with the blur of her fingers then. Anger made her gestures rapid and slurred.
I saw the way you fought out there, she went on. I've never seen anything like it. You must have killed hundreds. So why were you here, and why were we there? Why were we left to fester, and you given all this to revel in?
Her fingers were stabbing now, jutting towards me like physical accusations.
So the war's come to terror now. I might even be pleased about that. Maybe it'll stir you out of your damned laziness, though I fear it's too late for that now.
I may have misinterpreted some of that diatribe. My suspicion is that Thoughtmark contained several expletives in its lexicon that I was unable to decipher. However, the core of her meaning was perfectly clear.
You must have suffered gravely, I said, doing my best not to antagonize her further. Where were you stationed?
Eraser. Heard of that? No, of course not. You've been stuck in the palace so long you'd barely be able to find your way to the front gate if your menials didn't hold your hands.
She was wrong about that. I knew precisely where Eraser was, an industrial world deep in the heart of the Segmentum Solar, one of the many hundreds that comprised the productive center of the Imperium. It raised militarum regiments and supported a range of sub-mechanicus-grade manufactures, as well as being a minor pilgrimage center for the adherents of the cult of Saint Utrosius. I felt it politic not to point this out, though. I doubt it would have improved things. I drew closer to her. Something about the map she was looking at disturbed me. The script was written in an ancient dialect, one that I recognized from my studies in the Forbidden Archives.
Where did you obtain this? I signed.
She looked up at me. You can read it? I took a closer look. The more I read, the more concerned I became. Over the centuries, my scholarship had encompassed a wide range of theological subjects. I had become versed in many languages, now forgotten by the wider Imperium. Some of them, I suspect, were spoken nowhere save those places only we and our ancient enemies could still go.
This is a tongue of lost Chthonia, I said out loud. A dialect that had died out long before that world was destroyed. It is the gravest heresy even to possess such a thing. If the Inquisition knew you had it.
What does it mean?
My eyes passed over the swirls, running down arcane patterns that eluded sense. It was a representation of the warp. That was plain enough. Although I had always believed such things were of limited use, the Empyrean changed all the time, mutating itself and twisting into new forms. A fixed diagram would only be of service at a specific moment, and to be able to predict the warp's future form was beyond even the greatest of our prognosticators. Some aspects, though, I could decipher. Star systems were marked in Chthonian script, given figurative names that I could deduce from my knowledge of the stellar cartography around the Sol region. The more I looked, the more became evident.
This is an invasion scheme, I signed, switching again to Alea's mode of discourse. Centered on Terra, marking 8 cardinal conduits through which a fleet could pass. Here are the worlds, all within a single warp stage, all sitting at the mouths of secure ether channels.
Alea had lost her earlier irritation and now looked at her map with hungry eyes.
S thought it must be something like that, she signed, using a name form I didn't recognize. But he couldn't read it. Can it be used?
I committed the schema to memory. Even as I worked, I was contemplating what must be done with it. If accurate, this was of the highest value, and notice should be sent to the High Lords without delay.
Where did you get it? I signed.
I broke up a cabal, the Circlet, they were called. The last thing I did before the galaxy began to break. She looked up at me. The Black Legion were on their heels. They were involved in this thing, working through mortal cults across void stations.
It must be taken to the Council, then, if an attack is planned. She glared at me.
I suffered to retrieve this. My convent suffered. We were being picked off. If you know where these places are, we go there now. We burn them before they burn us. She was utterly serious. The muster of Null Maidens was only just complete. The attack on the Lion's Gate had only just been seen off. Our forces were in disarray, and gathering significant numbers for a fresh assault on such flimsy grounds would be difficult, probably impossible. But I could not ignore the threat. Alea was not wrong about what she had. This was surely part of the same grand assault, a fragment of the same strategy that had conspired to fracture the skein of the warp and silence the beacon of the Emperor. Our enemies knew we were half blind and reeling, and so they would strike close and strike soon. If this truly were evidence of where they would make their first move, then it needed to be used. She noticed my hesitation, though. That was the most legitimate of the many criticisms that we endured in the years to come, that our long and patient vigil had made us too cautious, too bound to old rites, and unable to react decisively when the need arose.
"You say you owe a debt to me," she signed, rapidly and forcefully. "Discharge it, then. Show me how to find these places, and take me there."
I felt something unusual then, watching her thrust those flickering signs of thought mark at me. At the very least, I ought to have found her presumptuous, and at the worst, guilty of the gravest disrespect. But instead, I found myself unable to suppress the twitch of a smile. I admired this woman. I admired her lack of deception and her genuine fervor. By the throne, I even admired the way she conversed. Not that I expected that the sentiment would be readily reciprocated. Nothing about what she demanded was simple. We were in flux. The Captain General was with the Emperor himself, as was the Lord Commander Presumptive. The High Lords, in whose names the Imperium was still theoretically governed, were fully detained with the many tasks of recovery and rearmament. To do what she asked required influence that I did not possess. But there were ways around most obstacles. Dwelling in the snake's nest of the palace for as long as I had done had taught me that. "I know a person to whom this could be taken," I said. "If we do so, may I suggest, with all possible respect, that you leave the talking to me."
Chapter 25. Alea. I never for a moment believed that he would actually do it. I was merely taking out my frustrations on him in that cell, trying to make him feel as bad as I did, and yet he listened to me. And then he even did as I asked. Perhaps he really did believe all that talk about debts of honor, or maybe he saw the true danger of the map in a way that I did not. In any case, it forced me to look at him with rather different eyes. In truth, my desire to hunt down the planets on that damned flayed parchment was as much about getting off Terra as anything else. In my short time there, I found the place almost unbearably depressing. I was not seeing it at its best, of course, and I appreciated that the war had come suddenly and brutally to its walls, but even so my rancor towards it only intensified the longer I was there. There was never an apology. No official from the High Lords ever came to us and expressed regret for the way we had been treated. We were simply thrown into that hideous fortress, given our orders, and expected to form ourselves into an army that had not fought together for many thousands of years. They were fools, all of them, the High Lords, blind fools that were unworthy of our service. My only allegiance in those days was to him. That, and that alone, never faltered. I swore a vow that I would avenge my sisters in his name, but not in the name of the Council, and not at their bidding. Everything I would do from that point onwards would be framed within that prism of vengeance, and I looked forward ferociously to the coming of the enemy to the throne world, so I could visit such pain on them as they had on me. I never thought that Valerian would give me a route to this revenge, nor that it would happen so swiftly. He stood there in my cell with his soft, patient voice, ignoring my repeated insults and studying that infernal parchment, as if it were a fascinating but harmless piece of interesting illumination. Most infuriating of all, he proved impossible to provoke. Hatred seemed to have almost no purchase on him, as if it were an emotion he simply couldn't understand. Later, after I had spent more time in his company, I realized just how close to the mark that judgment was. It was actually more a case, I think, of his having no conception whatsoever of pride. He had no ego to bruise. He saw his entire life as a pure expression of service and wished for nothing more than that. His only ambition of any kind was to serve the throne more perfectly. If he had been ordered to throw his armor away and stand in the path of demonic arrows, he would have done so without complaint. That was the key difference between him and, say, a space marine. A space marine was a creature of incredible internal pride, a warrior breed of such bellicosity that they would go to war, and had done, over matters of martial insult or the resentments of their flawed primarchs. Valerian would never have done that. In that distinction, I felt, was both his greatest strength and his most profound weakness. We went from the cell, taking a picture image of the map and leaving the original in its stasis field. As we went, I could tell that he was communicating, sending urgent requests for a meeting ahead of us, even as he kept up the flawless stream of thoughtmark with me. We passed into finer parts of the palace, with high stained glass windows and gold-chased columns. I saw few warriors, but many menials, and even more adeptus scribes, all racing from one task to another like a herd of startled bovines. The scale of it all was numbing rather than impressive. An endless warren of chamber after chamber, hall after hall, linked by a filigree of bridges and transit arches that wove through the toxic air and turned the mind. He guided us expertly, walking swiftly but never hurrying. His wound, which I had thought might have been terminal, was by then hardly in evidence. His powers of recuperation, I surmised, were as impressive as his ability not to take offence. Soon we had entered some truly grand regions, basilicas and mansions that piled atop one another in a bacchanalia of cumulative construction. Through narrow portals I caught glimpses of the very centre of it all, the colossal Sanctum Imperialis itself, rising against the northern horizon like some continental landmass, part masked by the haze of distance. I wondered briefly if we would go anywhere near it, and my interest was piqued. Hestia had always told us that only two orders were permitted into the presence of the Emperor himself, the custodians and ourselves. One day, I thought to myself, one day. But then our path turned away from it, and we were climbing into ostentatious rooms lined with mirrors and hung with thick tapestries. The luxury was obscene. Just one of the many artifacts that littered those galleries could have been ransomed for the annual tithe of an entire planet. The courtiers that we passed by in those places I found repugnant. They bowed low to Valerian and to me, but I found the shallow subservience disgusting. One woman had the temerity to flash me a timid smile, so I shot her a thought-marked stunned gesture that sent her reeling into a table full of glassware. At the end of it, we found ourselves ushered into one of the most opulent rooms of all, a veritable magpie's nest of ancient objects and antiquaries. I looked around it all, trying to gauge how much coin it must have taken to assemble. Soon afterwards, heavy doors at the far end of the chamber opened smoothly and two figures entered. One was a woman, fairly young, with a clever face and a dancer's erect bearing. The other was a man, older, with a heavy paunch and thick lines under his eyes. Neither of them looked like they'd slept for a long time, and their fine robes couldn't hide a certain quiet desperation. The man greeted Valerian with warmth, though.
"Shield, Captain,"
he said, holding out both hands.
This is an unexpected pleasure.
I wish it were under better circumstances, Valerian replied.
Chancellor Tyrann, this is Tanau Alea of the Sisters of Silence.
Honored, Tyrann signed.
I will be swift, Valerian said. Is this chamber secure? Come now.
The sister has evidence of imminent attack on worlds within a single warp stage of Terra. I have images to show you, ones that I am prepared to vouch for. The targets are all in close proximity and might be reached and defended if a task force were launched soon. The High Lords should be informed and arrangements made for immediate response.
Have you informed your Captain General?
Tyrann asked.
He is with the Emperor.
The Chancellor nodded, understanding what that meant. He looked at me.
Where did this evidence originate?
Helion Quintus, I signed back, though that matters little. They have knowledge of the coming state of the warp, and have isolated 8 open conduits leading here. All of them are so close as to be virtually on top of us. Tyrann looked pained by that, as if those tidings could possibly have been unexpected. I don't know what he thought the enemy would do after coming so near to destroying the palace walls. A secondary assault would always have been on its heels.
Grave tidings indeed,
he said, moving awkwardly over to a chair and sitting flabbily in it.
And they come at the worst possible time.
He looked up at Valerian.
You remember our old dealings with that issue of dissolution? You remember how that went?
He shook his head.
If only that was still the most pressing matter on my table.
I shot a quick glance at his companion then. She had not been introduced, but I could tell that she was more than a functionary. They were a unit, these two, and she radiated a quiet, steady intelligence.
The High Lords have shut down the system,
Tyrann said, wearily.
They're recalling every remaining scrap of defense to the palace and forbidding off-world movement. The master of the Administratum is scared. He's scared of the enemy, and he's just as scared of Gilliman. And he somehow thinks that both can be fended off by hoarding our remaining forces. So let me give you a brief answer to your question. There will be no counter-attack, not from the Council. While the Astronomicon remains dark, and the balance of power here has yet to be decided, no ships will launch from Terra.
The fools, I signed.
An astute judgment, sister, said Tyrann. But they're close to losing everything now, and that makes them reach for poor policies.
You will inform them nonetheless, said Valerian. Tyrann laughed.
I'll make it a priority, though it won't make any difference.
He rubbed his eyes.
The Lord Gilliman is here now, and that cannot be altered. When he emerges from his commune with the Emperor, he'll be the undisputed Lord Commander of the Imperium, and nothing Hemotalian can do will stand in the way of that. Until then, though, we're paralyzed, locked into old power games that we should have grown out of generations ago.
Valerian absorbed this quietly, as if he'd expected the news. I took it rather less well. Then damn them all, I signed. If they won't recognize it, we'll act without them.
They'll come after you if you try,
Tyrann told me. Let them.
And such action would, of course, be outside the law.
You truly think I care? The Chancellor chuckled.
Careful. I've spent my life defending that law.
He glanced back at Valerian.
See, when I tried to see the Lex changed in Council, it was the strangest thing I'd ever done. I still can't explain why I did it unless...
He searched for the words.
unless it reflected a greater design than mine. Perhaps my mistake was to interpret it too literally. The Lex did not need to be changed, because it's clear now the Lex is destined to be dismantled. But the idea, that was important. He looked down at his hands. To set the 10,000 free, he murmured, to unleash the talons of the Emperor. The Council will never allow it. Gilliman might never allow it. I now think that, if it is the right thing to do, you might have to seize the chance yourselves. At that point, I do not think Valerian was close to being convinced. He was still so bound to his lifetime's devotion to duty, interpreted as the labyrinth of rules and customs that had always given him purpose. I was already preparing to storm out, to find some way of getting off-world and forcing the issue myself, but then Tyrann said something else that did the seemingly impossible. "I have come to believe," the Chancellor said, "that in failure often lies our best sign of truth. I failed in the Council, and only now see that I was cleaving to a doomed course. The harder I pushed, the more I was resisted. I couldn't cross the threshold. I should have taken that, I think, as a sign to examine my instincts." Valerian suddenly looked shaken. He still said nothing, though those words had clearly struck some kind of chord. I, though, was impatient to be going. It was clear we would not receive any help from this source, and if Valerian could merely give me the names I needed, there was nothing to stop me taking matters into my own hands. "We have to act ourselves, then," I signed, uncaring what the Chancellor might make of that. "We have to defy the law." The custodian turned towards me slowly, and it took him a long time to force the next words out. I could see something of his difficulty even then, but now that I know more of him, and now that I know more of the world he inhabited for so long, I think I understand just how impossibly hard it must have been to express them. And that makes me admire him very much for what he did just then.
"Indeed so, sister,"
he signed, unusually awkwardly and with none of his usual fluency.
"I believe, all things considered, you may be right."
I went back to our makeshift fortress. Valerian took his leave almost immediately, offering nothing but his word that he would return with the means for me to realize my goal. Looking back, I find my attitude towards him incredibly trusting. We had been thrown together by the slenderest of chances, but already I found it impossible to imagine him failing to do what he said he would. There was something almost childlike about his attitude to truth, though it was probably reckless to rely on it so much at the very beginning. I was, though, consumed by the urgent need to act on what we had found. My quest to return to Terra had always been part of a greater mission, to discover those responsible for the destruction of my home, and I shrugged off any lingering fatigue to pursue it with renewed energy. I knew that time was short. The locations identified by Valerian were very close, almost within spitting distance of Terra itself. If the enemy had arrived at those places already, then we were barely beyond the range of their guns, even where we stood, and I could understand the High Lords wishing to reserve all our forces for where the final assault must surely come. If I had thought about things more clearly, I would have realized just what a mad game we were playing. There was little chance of us mustering more than a token strike force in the time we had available. Something that could be cobbled together quickly and hurled into the face of an oncoming armada. It was all fairly suicidal, I suppose, and a part of me realized it from the beginning. I had no complaint with that. I would have died 100 times over just for the chance of facing the Legion that had brought destruction to Eraser. But I wondered then what Valerian's attitude must have been. He would not, I thought, have risked his life just for the sake of a vow made in the heat of battle.
His devotion to the throne would override any sense of personal honor he might have cultivated. So why was he doing this? Something that Tyrann had told him must have tipped the balance. But whatever it was, the sense of it had passed me by. Do not look for any more justification than that. Perhaps there was always an element of madness in what we planned. Motivated by my exasperation with the High Lords, and exacerbated by my still-hot heartache. I will not apologize for it, and I would have done the same thing again in exactly the same way. I was built to fight, to be a hunter rather than the hunted, and it disgusted me that so many of our allies preferred to remain behind the walls rather than sally out beyond them. So when I got back to those dank and crowded cells, I sought out Reaver first. We had conversed often in the days since being thrown together, and I had discovered a woman after my own heart. She was fearless, devoted to her highest duty, and was, most importantly, contemptuous of those who gave us our orders. We had even joked about stealing off-world before the true chance came, but under our sarcasm had always been an element of real desire. I found her in the half-built practice cages, pirouetting and thrusting with the great blade we had both taken as our signature weapon. She had recovered her full fighting potential rather more quickly than I had, and now moved with a ferocious grace again. I watched her for a while, letting the impression of it sink in, before she noticed me, pulled her leather training helm from her head, and came towards me. "You look serious," she signed. "Can we discuss something?" I responded. She looked at me quizzically, as if worried she might be the subject of a jest, but then her smile died. "Anytime," she signed. Persuading her was easier than I had feared it might be. We all knew that battle was coming anyway, and the chance to steal a march on it was appealing to her sense of adventure. The ban on off-world movement was something that chafed with all of us, until so very recently we'd been effectively banned from coming anywhere near the throne world, so to be shackled here was yet another indignity we yearned to throw off. "We will likely not return from this," I signed, to be sure she understood. "You say they are Black Legion," she countered. "If that's right, then I care not." We began to spread our message, working only with those we reckoned would be sympathetic. We avoided those who had served in the League of Black Ships, for their loyalty to the Adeptus Terror was absolute, and if the High Lords had told them to remain on-world, then they would do so slavishly. The most promising recruits were those like us, the cast-offs and the long-term renegades, many of whom had suffered from raids similar to that launched against Erasa, and also burned to avenge them. I don't know, even now, whether those many attacks were all linked to the circlet. It may be that the Black Legion saw us as unique threats to their general strategy and made sure to finish as many of us off as possible before we became aware of it. Or it may be that we were simply there, isolated and ripe for the taking. For myself, I think there must have been a connection. I cannot think it random that those from whom I took that map were also working with those who ransacked my convent, and it was this artifact that remained our only link to what was already unfolding. By the end, we recruited 32 of our number, 32 sisters who were so disillusioned with our treatment that they would willingly become involved in a raid that was both illegal and likely to result in our swift deaths. I found that both heartening and moving. We had all lived our entire lives in an imperium defined by fear and the foolish adherence to central authority. One ironic consequence of our neglect by that authority was that we had never been infected by its most pernicious effects, and were as close as any of our species ever came to having a mind of our own. The hour came. We armed ourselves and marched en masse to the hangars. We were lucky that our fortress was in such disarray. There were few guards on station, and little more than an ad hoc mechanism for summoning and discharging landers. Some token resistance was offered from the garrison commander and a scattered squad of his troops, but a very gentle application of our more unpleasant null projection techniques soon had them vomiting energetically over the rock crete and clutching their migraine-split temples. I had still not heard from Valerian. I never doubted his honesty, but it occurred to me that he would have run into far stiffer resistance than I would have. Perhaps he had failed in securing the void transport that he'd intended to. I began to consider whether we would have to make use of the semi-ruined Kadamara, which still hung in high orbit but was only barely void-worthy. Erifan would still take an order, I knew, though Slovo might be a different matter. I didn't even know for sure that he remained on board, or even if he was still alive. I voxed the custodian over the classified channels he had given me, then took my place in the lander. We boosted the thrusters and took off, clearing the open hangar exit and pulling steeply up into the atmosphere. I looked out of the armor glass portals as we ascended, watching the spoil grey sprawl of Terra spread out beneath us. The scars of the battle were clearly visible, a black straggle of burned earth that spread out for many square kilometres. For a brief moment, I had a perfect view of the palace itself, that colossal accumulation that was more continent than city, and realised only then just how vast it was. The place must have housed millions upon millions of defenders, against which our hastily assembled band was almost infinitesimally unimportant. But it wasn't, of course. A part of me knew that even then. We pulled into orbit, and the view from the portals sank into inky black. Void craft were clustered there in huge numbers, more than would normally have been the case, since so many had been pulled back from outer system patrol. Immediately, Adeptus Arbites system runners began to hail us, and a naval destroyer bearing the ident Superlative began to turn towards our locus. I saw the challenge hails multiply on our forward augers, all of them demanding a full stop and transmission of exemption credentials. We were a long way from the Kadamara. Reva looked at me, and I knew what she was thinking. "Maintain course and speed," I signed to the pilot. The destroyer fired up its engines and began to glide towards us. I saw its gunnery panels lever open and detected 7 more Enforcer gunships enter the vicinity of our sensors. We had seconds before those hails turned into shells. Reva looked at me again. I began to speculate on whether this would be the shortest raid in Imperial history, calculating whether we would boost our way to the Kadamara before we were hemmed in and turned into atoms. Just then, though, something much bigger swam into our visual range. A ship of such outrageous, vulgar ostentation that it could only originate from the Adeptus Custodes. It was arrayed like a land-based fortress, piled with crenellations and outsized thruster housings and glinting with dirty gold. Valerian's voice crackled over the comm. "Recommend coming aboard with all haste, sister," he said. "They won't fire on us yet, but we do not have forever." We guided the lander into the void ship's open hangar, slipping under the lintel of heavy brass. Every surface of that ship was ornate and gilded, broadcasting the majesty and heritage of its occupants. It was huge, too, covered in weaponry the like of which I had never seen before, and which I guessed dated back a long way. That ship might have been the oldest thing in orbit, though it must have been among the least powerful of the Adeptus Custodes' formidable arsenal. Valerian met us at the hangar, clad in full armor and accompanied by 9 of his brothers. It was a paltry band in terms of numbers, but in truth more than I had expected. "The sodality of the Palaeologian Chamber," he announced. "My brothers of war. They have vowed to aid me." I bowed to them, unsure what that meant. Had they been ordered to accompany us? Or did they choose to follow their shield captain?
Surely it was the latter, for this went against everything they had sworn to uphold. I wondered what he had said to convince them. 10, I signed, almost without thinking. Valerian smiled.
It will be enough.
In anyone else, even a space marine, I would have called that arrogance. With him, it was never possible to be sure. I felt the ship's walls rumble as the plasma drives kicked in. We began to move, heading towards the inner core of the vessel.
This is the Chalandian,
Valerian told me.
A ship under my authority. Not the greatest in armament, but it will serve to get us there. We have the service of 3 navigators, and they understand the risks while the beacon remains silent.
Have you studied the map further? I signed, knowing that there was little I could do to decipher it. I was reliant upon him to dictate our course, given that of all of us only he understood the script and could make the link to the real planetary systems.
Vorlees is closest, he said,
reaching the blast doors and opening them onto a bright-lit corridor beyond.
I consulted the almanacs and engaged the tarot for guidance. It is a well-defended world, the home of 3 regiments and a naval battle group. It may stand yet, and if so, we will aid those who yet resist the enemy.
And if it's fallen already?
Then we will die, extracting what cost we can, before they move closer to the throne.
How far, then? I signed, anxious to get into the warp. Now that we had launched this thing, I would not be at ease until we reached our destination.
We will have to clear orbit, and that will not be easy, even for us.
He gave me a tolerant look, one that spoke of forbearance. Naturally enough, I found that infuriating.
But we will achieve it, sister, and after that we are in the hands of fate.
Chapter 26. Tyrion. I did what I could to aid them. I called in a few favors from those I could still trust, a dwindling band by then, and prevailed on High Lord Pereth to look the other way as they boosted clear of Terra's clogged local space. Jack was as diligent as ever, working furiously behind the scenes, both to hide our involvement and to ensure that the right palms were greased. Our union of convenience, which had originated on a professional basis, then deepened through a mutual terror, had now become something more profound. We were certainly no longer master and adjutant. Perhaps right and left hand would have captured it more accurately. So we achieved a small thing for them. The Chalandian cleared orbit and made the warp. Once they were away, we returned to that vortex of paranoia and disorder that passed for the Imperial administration at that dark time. The Council was riven between an increasingly despotic Hematalian and a rump of more reasoned voices, all of them occupied with overlapping and competing attempts to claw back some level of control over the palace's vast and complex machinery of government. As the days passed, and no repeat of the great demonic incursion took place, some achievements were accomplished. A temporary defense line was re-established over the ruins of the Lion's Gate, and rebuilding even began. Punitive raids were launched into the burned-out wreckage of the Eternal City, and several hab-zones were tentatively retaken by forces loyal to the throne. We established contact with a number of other contiguous regions where order had never quite been eradicated, and the prospect of resuming our old habits of iron control began to dangle tantalizingly before us. Throughout all of this, I remained preoccupied with that final conversation with Valerian and Elea. I had little doubt that my words had been instrumental in their decision to subvert Valex and take ship. Such a thing had never been heard of, and if the truth of it were ever to emerge, then my life would likely be forfeit. I didn't care too much about that, of course, but I did remain anxious that my intervention might not have been the right one. After all, what did I know of the Emperor's will? How could I even begin to offer opinions about such a subtle and obscure subject? If I had ever had any claim to importance, it was as a politician, not a scholar. I wondered often if I should have stuck to what I was good at. I consoled myself that despite the precedent being broken, the possible harm done was slight. It was a single ship, no more than that, just a way for me to spite Haematalian's knee-jerk ban and allow those who had fought bravely the right to find their own path to death. If the sister was right about a coming assault on that ring of worlds, then they would be swept aside by it, just as Haster had been, though at least they would end their lives as he had done, on the offensive. Another concern made itself apparent during those days. Once the terrible shock had worn off, whispered voices began to be raised concerning the assault on the Lion's Gate. Clearly, it had been the work of some power of nigh infinite malevolence, but if so, then it was something of a mystery why it had failed. For all the terror it had inspired, the creatures had not got close to the Eternity Gate, and I felt that even in the absence of the Lord Gilliman they would never have done so. Was it merely a statement of intent, then, to show that no worlds were beyond their reach now? Many began to advance that thesis, taking some comfort in the fact that we had nevertheless endured it. I, though, continued to have nagging doubts, as if we were missing something important and dangerous, though I could not quite put my finger on it. I might have made more of both doubts, had two things not happened that once again turned everything inside out. The first was the great development that we had all been fervently hoping for. The Astronomicon's signal flickered, then went out again, then finally re-emerged. I heard the news first from Kerapliades, who voxed me triumphantly as the first signs of return began to flow into the Astropath's choir towers. At first I hardly dared to believe it, but the master of the Astronomicon himself issued official confirmation soon afterwards, sending the news via secure channels to his peers on the Council and their senior advisers. The fortress lit up, and great columns of pent-up energy snarled around its iron crown, as they had done before. Jack and I both raced to the balcony of our tower and looked up into the skies, which were already beginning to clear. It was impossible not to cry out with relief and elation at the dissipation of that oppressive curtain of bloody swirling. Never had I been so pleased to see the familiar steel-grey shroud of our old poisons return to enclose us, and we embraced and kissed and laughed like fools. I never discovered the cause of the Astronomicon's failure, nor understood the means by which it was eventually restored. It may be that Raskian had been able to resolve some mechanical problem, either in the throne itself or the mighty conduits that linked it to the fortress, though he never claimed credit for it if he had. The resumption of the beacon may have had something to do with Gilliman's sojourn in the throne room, although he also never spoke about what he had seen or done in there, at least with me, so that whole episode must remain pure conjecture. Whatever the reason, though, its return gave us more